This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. Iron Grindstone Lu's Feast. Iron Grindstone Lu went to Master Guishan, Ling Yao. Guishan said, "Old cow, so you've come." The iron grinder said, "Tomorrow in Mount Wutai there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher?" Guishan lay down and sprawled out. The iron grinder left immediately. Yan Wu, who is the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, comments, "The nun Iron Grindstone Lu was like a stone-struck spark, like a lightning flash, hesitate, and you lose your body and your life. She had studied for a long time. Her active edge was sharp and dangerous." Quishan is over 600 miles from Mount Tai. How then did Iron Grindstone Lu want to have Guishan go to the feast? Tell me, what was her meaning? This old lady understands Guishan's conversation. Fiber coming, thread going, one letting go, one gathering in. They answer back to each other like two mirrors reflecting each other, without any reflecting image to be seen. Action to action, they complement each other. Phrase to phrase, they accord. People these days can be poked three times and not turn their heads. But this old lady couldn't be fooled one little bit. So today I would like to introduce and bring into the space our heavy metal auntie, Iron Grindstone Lu. And she was probably the first named Zen woman I came across, and I found her pretty fascinating right from the start, just from that name. I mean, we're not talking about coffee or graham crackers. Iron. How does one get the name Iron Grindstone Lu? And this is a woman studying, of course, like many, with a male teacher. She's in the Chinese lineage, the number 19 that we chant on the list of women ancestors. And I was very glad to find someone like Iron Grindstone Lu, who had such a deep and playful relationship with her male teacher, Guishan. As we know, the Zen tradition has some formidable Zen women, Zen masters, Zen women masters. Her name, her family name was Ryu, which in Chinese was Lu, and Ketsu means iron, and Ma means mill. So she's the mill that grinds iron. And I kind of wanted to be like her. Tough as a feminine woman. Not like compared to a man, but just a woman who stands on her own. So she was someone I looked to as a role model. And this grinding stone, this iron grindstone, was because she could grind the monks to shreds, it said, in Dharma Encounter. Now, please know that's the great love, the great care for them, and cutting off their deluded way of thinking that she was really sharp. So she was born in 871, and her full name was Liu Tiemo. And in this koan, that kind of takes place towards the end of Guishan's life. It appears that she had her own temple, and I'll tell you a little bit about her family history later as we go on. But in this retreat, we've been reading some of the stories from the Therigatha, which is the, Theri means elder, so the elder women who, we don't really know from what I've read if they actually wrote those poems, but there's good reason to believe that they were written by women, and some of them by the ones we know. Some of them knew the Buddha up close, and some of them studied, you know, later with the female teachers as they came into there. And it's said to be, it's a collection of poems and to be read like literature. Like they called it in Southeast Asia, crooked speech. So these poems are said to say something that isn't said directly. They're poems, but what they're saying isn't said directly, which is very much like a koan that we, you know, hear, such as this. And the poem depends on us, on our life at the same time. As we hear it, it brings our life in to meet it. It's got that spaciousness where it depends on how we see and how we've lived, and we will not see it in the same ways. That's the beauty of a poem, right? And when people tell their stories, everything changes. You know, not only are we legitimized in the telling of our story, we're found. We exist in the telling of our story. When we hear our story be told, when we hear their story be told, we exist in a community with others. I turn to them in my times of heartbreak and grief. They were a community that I knew that they had lived through some great difficulties, and as we heard, losing children and getting to such desperate measures as wanting to take their life. And that's when I started chanting their poems. And when I listened to their stories, I began to understand my own life better. We begin to find our way back through and with each other, with all of life. So in the koan, it's one of the many tools, as we know, that is available to a Zen teacher to help her student find a way to live in both worlds simultaneously of the relative and the absolute. Some people call it relative reality, some people call it consensus, some people call it binary reality, where everything is the way it is and can't be compared with other things that are the way they are. Snow and rain, up and down, sun and moon, left and right. And then in the realm of the absolute, distinctions disappear. The discursive human mind of practitioner moves back and forth between these two views. And I think Shugen Roshi spoke about two arrows meeting in air, and Zuisei Sensei spoke about that yesterday. And there is a felt sense, I think, when there is two arrows meeting in midair, when we experience that, and when there is a skim or a miss or a brush by, we feel that. We don't have it all In differences, we need to see the truth of worlds meeting. And that's what allows us to work well with healing our karma. So as happy as I was to find her, and many Zen women, or these women of the Therigatho, we don't find many details so that we can form a personal connection with them. We have some, but we don't know exactly. We don't know how they were transformed or who they were before they came to practice. The Therigatha speaks very frankly of their lives before practice. It mentions that they were poor, some of them outcasts, some from very rich royal aristocracy, mothers, courtesans, harassed, and the choice to be ordained. We hear about difficult times, the body changing form. But in the Zen stories, there's not much found and that I've read that and I haven't found how they found their way in difficult times, what the difficulties were. So we're kind of left to wonder what they were really like. And how can they serve as role models? We are told these named people are women, but we don't hear much of a hint about their female identity, behavior, or life experience. You know, like I was like, hey, Grinder, what's menopause like in a monastery? How you doing with your hormones? Do you have any lovers? Are you gay? How's your health? Did you give up having children for the Dharma? How about men? Any of you identify as, how about you men? And if any of you identify as women, were you wearing women's clothes under your robes? I have to think that this was probably going on. This was happening, has always been. And there was great suffering and suffocating. Miriam Levering writes, "We always hear about women's contributions in male conquest language. We are without any images or archetypes of female or feminine Zen master. While classic portrayals show Zen included women, patriarch Zen never became androgynous, incorporating the varied experiences of both men and women as a way of enriching the tradition." I know when I came into practice here, there was only three monks, Nyotai, Shugen, Jimon, and there was a postulant, Jinpu. And so very quickly I was in the role of a senior student because I stayed more than a year. And I really struggled with this. I struggled to own my power, but just my role. I was glad Miyotai Sensei was here. She gave me, she was a teacher, she was the head monk, and she was a woman and was very seated in her womanness. And in her story, my story, when I acted strongly and clearly, I was criticized, like many of us. You're too much. You're too much. You're not enough. You're not enough. So this was what landed in my mind as truth. pull up your bootstraps. Don't be so emotional. You're taking it too personally. Were some offerings to my troubled mind. What is true power? True power. I have this book I was looking at from time to time. It's not something you want to read from cover to cover. At least I don't. It's called Power Versus Force by this guy named Hawkins, David Hawkins, not Stevens. And he says, power arises from meaning. It has to do with motive and it has to do with principle. Power is always associated with that which supports the significance of life itself. It appeals to that part of human nature we call noble. In contrast, force, which appeals to what we may call crass, must justify, always justify, and is associated with partial and moves against things. It is incomplete, and so it needs to be fed energy constantly. Power appeals to what uplifts, dignifies, and ennobles. True power energizes and supports. And so in working with my teacher now, Shugen Roshi, his no-nonsense kind of willingness to not buy into my lack of self-confidence is helping me develop my capacity. He's not trying. It's how he lives. It's how he sees. We don't have much information of how these women lived as women, but we learned how they are transformed by Zen, how they serve to transform Zen monks, and how they serve to highlight great Zen masters. Grace Shearson brings in a term called Chang Fu, which is a manly woman. They actually have a name for it. As tough as nails female type, a she-man. And she notes that Liu Tiemo and Moshan Liao Run were two women who exemplify women who have been transformed into male Zen heroes in the literature. Just bringing that up. You can agree or disagree or investigate it. But Liu's life was a hard one. At the time of her life, the aristocracy fattened, and the peasants got steadily thinner. And she lived with her father, and they were peasants. And they worked on a rich man's plot of land, breaking endless work. Apparently they had to carry on their shoulders buckets of dirt to fill in a plot to grow things. From what little I know, that those buckets might have been fecal matter to fertilize the ground. That's what was often done. So that's what she did, like, all day. Down and up, down and up. It's said that sophisticated women at that time read the classics, wrote poetry, practiced music, and calligraphy. They wore their hair tied up in a bun with decorative pins, wore silk robes with elaborate decorative patterns made of silk. As a peasant, they were taxed on food, land, salt, incense, tea, clothing, alcohol, and spoons. I guess they use spoons a lot. I don't know why they weren't charged on chopsticks. Some babies were allowed to live, some were not. Some were sold as debt slaves, as soon as they were able to walk. This was interesting. I don't know where they got this one. She was described as being short, stout, plain, with big feet. Now, the big feet might have been because she was not from the aristocracy where they did foot binding. It was said that, you know, if you know about foot binding, having these tiny little crumpled feet that you can't get away was beautiful. And it was how they would just walk. You could hardly walk. You know, you'd have to, you were on these very small bent feet. Happened when you were very young. Said she had flat, hard hands like small boulders. So she couldn't do delicate work like sewing, calligraphy, or playing the lute or flute. And it was written that she walked through the Zhao Mountains and a pass, and there were giant rock cliffs with Buddhas. And it was made of this ochre, clay, smooth soil. And it said when the sun glowed, there was so much of this soil in the air that it was golden light. And one day, when she was old enough, she simply walked away. She left her father taking care of the plot. And she thought, if all life has to offer was hunger at work, at least she can choose where she was hungry. So she did go, and then she went through this pass, saw these giant rock cliffs of Buddhas, of the ochre silt, soft as flour. And she stopped at convents on the way for shelter. Many were sanctuaries for women who had been displaced, divorced, widowed women without children, women who were beaten by their husbands. For this reason, many thought the convents were very unsavory places. Many of the nuns couldn't read or write, but they were safe, and it was a reliable place. And she grew to love these carved statues that were in this ochre, soft silt. These serene faces surrounded by curly hair. It looked different than anyone she'd ever seen before. The eyes were lowered peacefully. They were sitting on lions and dragons and elephants, sometimes raging waves. And they were sometimes very calm in the midst of raging fires and tsunamic waves. She imagined that perhaps she herself could sit on anything with the same stillness in the midst of poverty, pain, injustice. And she wondered, can statues be teachers? We make an image of a Buddha, someone did, sitting. In Zazen, we place one on an altar and make offerings with the sincere wish to meet our awakened nature, a reminder, an identity. What about these images? What do you feel when you engage, when you bow? I always identified with the Kanon, well, more recently, right there on the right, in her royal ease posture, that someone could hear the cries of the world with their legs open, just that vulnerable. When we put forth an inquiry or an aspiration wholeheartedly, we may notice a response. If we're quiet, paying attention, we will find it is perceived and subtly answered. if our inquiry, it will be offered with our respect and reverence. And in a way, this koan with her, with Iron Grindstone and her teacher, offers a model of this reverence and this respect, going both ways. So when we wholeheartedly engage in that bow or that meeting of an image, we will engage, we will feel in a subtle way that same respect, that same reverence returned. When we sit down for Zazen and start working through all kinds of problems with the conceptual mind, releasing ourselves, eventually catching ourselves, a little bit of intention arises to stop and settle right here and now. That's a response, a response that comes from wisdom, from compassion. We put forth the intention and the response is right there. A deep breath of relaxation, ease, presence. Buddha meets and confirms we are on the right track. A baby bodhicitta is born. Mystical communion with inconceivable Buddha nature. Small mind resonating with big mind. This illusory being we call me softens her grip, releasing to an enormous size. Enormous. I don't know if you've ever heard the song by Stormy Large. She sings, "My vagina is 8 miles wide. Every single being is welcome to come inside." She says, "I am enormous. Get used to it. Get used to it." So she felt this looking at these images. She felt her immensity. And then she aimed for Chang'an, which was a city, and she'd never been to a city before. And she came to the Water and Land Convent, which also had all these statues like nothing she could ever imagine. Thousands of them made in clay on every wall, which were recreating the story of the Buddha's life. And she stood before them, just transfixed, just studying them. Taking them in slowly, every detail, seeing how alive these figures were because she felt so alive, they came alive. The response was there. She watched how they grew in the darkness, close to the peak of the ceiling, disappearing behind the beams, figures reading scrolls, sitting in pagodas, riding horses, swans, surrounded by arhats, wild, multi-armed, fiery-haired protector demons. And staring at this wall, she saw her own life. She saw her grandfather's. She saw her father's. There was no mention of her mother. She realized how ordinary evil could be, how inattentive and distant. She saw the power of not being afraid to die. She saw refuge, protection. She sat there on a mat in the cold hall, by candlelight in silence and just followed her breath between lives. And when she went to the city just to see it, it had 81 monasteries and 28 convents. Can you imagine, like, if you went to New York City and it was like 81 monasteries and 21 convents? But when she went to the city, she went through it and then she was done. It held no interest. She entered the nearest convent and asked to be ordained. Eventually, the nuns obliged. And soon she searched further to look for a teacher, following the Buddha's path, and she met Guishan. Guishan was a Dharma heir of Bajang, Yakujo, who received transmission from Baso, Mazu. Mazu was said to have 84 enlightened disciples. So it was a fruitful time for him. Yakujo was one of the 84 enlightened disciples, and he transmitted to several people. One was Obaku, who became the teacher in the Rinzai line, who transmitted to Isan, who along with his Dharma successor, Kyogen, became another line, and that continued for generations. And they were part of what we call the five houses of Zen in China at that period of time. Another one of those houses was the Tozan school or the Soto school. Both the Rinzai and Soto lineages are part of you, your training, your being here, the transmission that's happening now in your practice, mind to mind, all the way back centuries. It's here now. This is the feast. These are the only two, the Soto and the Rinzai and the Soto, that continued through time and are still alive today. And she trained under Guishan and became his 43rd Dharma heir. So perhaps in this koan, you can feel a conversation that is embodied. Old cow, so you've come. Grinder said, tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher? He laid down and sprawled out, and she turned around and left. It doesn't rely on words. Maybe it is that crooked speech. It's saying something, but it's not said what we're to see. They're having a very, very deep conversation, and their connection is in their bodily actions. So, to me, it's just so refreshing to see two people so playful as they are in this case, both embracing, disregarding gender, just embodied together. Enkyo Sensei, in her commentary in this koan and the hidden lamp, calls the exchange a perfect, satisfyingly complete, heartbreakingly intimate. Where is the feast, I ask you? Are you coming or are you going? His laying down, her leaving him. They understood each other and there was a complete response. Whenever people ask about reincarnation, I always tell them to look at this piece because Guishan calls her old cow. And in English, calling a woman an old cow might not go over so well. But in this relationship, it functions as a recognition of their sameness, because he was known as a water buffalo. That's how he identified himself, as a water buffalo, saying that that was the form in which he would be reborn. There's a koan about that. One day you'll see me at the front gate, reborn as a buffalo. You know. Here, the male buffalo and the female cow meet, ready to engage. Tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher? He just laid down and sprawled out. She turned around and left. There's only one detail in this koan that's important. It's a geographical fact. Mount Wutai, as I said in the beginning, is 600 miles or more from where Guishan was living. So where is this gathering, this feast? Where is this place where the feast is celebrated? The mountain. This isn't 600 miles away, even if in the geographical, conventional sense, it is 600 miles away. In the actual world, where is Mount Wutai? Here. Here is Mount Wutai. Where else can it be? I remember when I went to a mime school way years back, and just before I came to the monastery. It was called Le Centre du Silence. I saw the little ad, Le Centre du Silence, mime school, and I was like, yeah, I'm going there. And the reason was because I wanted to learn more about embodiment. I felt, you know, I was painting still lifes, and I thought, and I wanted to be closer to being the object, a bottle, a bowl. I was putting out my bowls. I was just painting bowls or bottles, and I just wanted to, like, be a bowl. So I thought, in mime, you have to describe reality in such detail with your embodiment. That's how we know if it's a mug of beer or a champagne glass. So I went. It was in Colorado. And there was all these directions, like, meet at the pink mailbox at 4 o'clock, and this covered wagon sort of thing's going to pick you up and bring you to where you need to go. I thought this was, like, already I was having a blast, you know. I was on the mountain, and, like, wow, a pink mailbox? And I got there, and there was another woman there, and it was, like, a brutally hot day, like some that we've had, a scorcher. And she was just like, oh, my God, it's so hot. Like, on and on and on. And I actually fell in love with her, like, her complaining. There's something so endearing about all her complaints. It made me very quiet and cool, but I really appreciated her. And she was like, and then she finally noticed I was there and said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Le Centre du Silence." She says, "Me too." She goes, "What's with the pink mailbox? And what's going to pick us up?" And just this anxiety, you know. And sure enough, something in between a wagon, a jitney, and a bus came with, like, covered awnings to pick us up. It had little seats in it. It was kind of like a Colorado makeup job of a vehicle. And we went there, and we're going up these mountains, and it's very exciting, boulders. And all of a sudden, we pop out in like this new neighborhood, like an urban neighborhood. It was so upsetting, you know. I was like, oh, my God. I thought I was going back into the forest, you know. And we got out, and it was the Watergate hearings. It felt like I was in Disney World. There was, like, somebody playing basketball, and, like, you could hear every bounce. It was very quiet, and you'd hear, like, pum, pum. And then a guy was fixing his car, his muffler, and he had the Watergate tapes, Watergate hearings playing as he was working on his car, and you could hear the clanking of him banging with his wrench. And we got off, and we're, like, walking down the street, and then we see some people, and there's a guy in striped pants with suspenders. I figured that's where we're going, you know? Who else? And so we get there, and it's just a house, right? Just a house. And she's, like, so sweaty and, like, frustrated, and she goes, like, "Where is le centre du silence?" And he comes up to her and appropriately puts his hand on her chest and says, "Mademoiselle, where is le centre du silence?" And she did not talk. I said, "Okay, let the fun begin. We've got a little wizard here." Just went right in. Wherever we are, we're always in the same place. Everything is complete. Every problem is solved or not solved, but it's here, right now, here, where you've always been, where you always will be. In past, present, and future, that is constantly being recalibrated. And that defies all our concepts and desires in its absolute perfection. So we can think of all the suffering we endure in a period of zazen or any time, wanting to be somewhere else, wanting to be something, someone else, wanting something to be something else. I want to be different. I want it to be different. I want you to be different. That's my suffering. The times we're so convinced that some external or internal situation was so horrible and so completely unacceptable. We wanted so desperately, we do, to go to Mount Wutai. But there's no way we can get there. Full of regret and anguish. And there's nothing we could do about it. But Guishan knows better. Are you going? He lays down. He rests. He offers us his ease. He turns and stretches out for a nap. Yanwu said, "Guishan made an accurate hit himself. Two arrows have met in midair. The mist is dissipated. Any confusion set aside. Mount Wutai, right there. The grindstone packs up and goes home. Mount Wutai in every step." She leaves. There's nothing more to say. Now that's a celebration. That's a feast. The capacity to quickly transform from oneness to differentiation at the moment that situation pivots. ready to change in a heartbeat? Isn't that our study? Isn't that our integration? Isn't that our liberation for ourselves and for all beings, learning to live in both the worlds of oneness and form so we can dance together, dance with ourselves? It's not small. Guishan and grindstone are completely and utterly in union with one another. There's no record, as I said, but probably they never saw each other again because he died shortly after this encounter, it said. But whether they did or not doesn't really make a difference. They can't but always help to see one another. That's my question to myself, and I pose to you, how can I live? How can you live where we can't but always help to see one another as ourself, as myself, as who you are? This is why we say their names. Bring them to life, to see another as ourselves. When we have confidence in this, then nothing whatsoever is missing. Our anguish and our suffering are complete, just as it is.
Thanks so much for listening. Please join us on October 18th to 21st at Zen Mountain Monastery for A Sudden Flash of Spaciousness, an introduction to mind training with Buddhist teacher and writer Judy Leaf. For details or to find out more about ZMM programs, visit our website at zmm.org.